This is Twit.
All right, let's talk about whatever that is.
Okay, so Blindside first. And these guys are going to be familiar to us, a team consisting of five super sharp researchers at ETH Zurich, the Stevens Institute of Technology, and the University of Amsterdam, including our old friend, Professor Herbert Boss, has just managed to oh so cleverly leverage Spectre-style processor performance optimizations in such a way that, first, they bypass any attempts to mitigate the processor's Spectre-style vulnerabilities. And then, second, leverage those vulnerabilities to successfully perform a so-called BROP, B-R-O-P, which stands for Blind Return-Oriented Programming. And this can be done in the face of the best KSLR, kernel address space layout randomization, while completely suppressing any wrong layout guess crashes. Okay, so let's back up a bit. I'll explain what they've done, because it's when you see the video, it is this week's Security Now video, a 4-minute video showing their proof of concept, which they start on a Linux terminal, and in 4 minutes it has root. So now I have your attention.
That's not good.
No. Okay, so let's back up a bit. You'll see, in fact, you have the video on screen. They first do a who am I, and they get some random username. We'll see 4 minutes later, after their system is finished cranking, they do another who am I, and you know who
somebody,
is the
somebody else, huh?
Then logged in. Yeah. Okay, so a previous work by researchers at Stanford University was titled Hacking Blind. And I've got a link to the abstract or to their whole paper, but the abstract describes what hacking blind is. They said, we show that it is possible to write remote stack buffer overflow exploits without possessing a copy of the target binary or source code against services that restart after a crash. This makes it possible to hack proprietary closed binary services or open source servers manually compiled and installed from source, where the binary remains unknown to the attacker. That's something that we've never really touched on before, is that the return-oriented programming assumes that you absolutely know the system that you're attacking, meaning you know what the ends of the subroutines that you're attempting to leverage with your so-called gadgets, you know what they are. But that's only the case when you have, when you know what the binary is. If you don't have an exact binary, you're stabbing in the dark. And that's exactly the point. That's what they meant by hacking blind. So they said traditional techniques are usually paired against a particular binary and distribution, where the hacker knows the location of useful gadgets for return-oriented programming. Our blind ROP or BROP attack instead remotely finds enough ROP gadgets to perform a write system call and transfers the vulnerable binary over the network, after which an exploit can be completed using known techniques. In other words, they're able to, by tolerating the fact that they're going to like over and over and over be crashing the service, because the service restarts. Well, in fact, I'm stepping on this. They said this is accomplished by leaking a single bit of information based on whether a process crashed or not when given a particular input string. BROP requires a stack vulnerability and a service that restarts after a crash. The attack works against modern 64-bit Linux with address space layout randomization, ASLR, no execute page protection, that is the NX, and stack canaries. So a fully instrumented, state-of-the-art attack. And Leo, I see that it is just about to finish.
Who am I?
Here we go.
Who am I?
And
I am Root. Yep. Or Groot.
Oh, baby.
Wow. So they got Root. But that's really interesting because they don't know the binary, but they're able to do it by probing?
Okay, so that first work that I mentioned, the work that Stanford did, it required a service that would auto restart.
Right.
So they were crashing it over and over and over.
Oh, and I get it. I get it.
And each time the one bit of information they obtained was, did it crash or not?
Right.
And so, okay, so on the other hand, as we've often noted, when a system contains a vulnerability, attempts to exploit that vulnerability more often than not simply crash. And in fact, that's what fuzzers do, right? They discover potentially weaponizable flaws by first crashing a system that should not be crashable. Then humans examine the execution path that the fuzzing triggered to see whether it might be exploitable. And as we know, one of the keys to spotting when a system might be under attack, active attack, is when the system's logs suddenly show that normally reliable processes are suddenly crashing and auto restarting for no obvious reason. Yeah, it could be buggy
code. Somebody's doing something.
Exactly. But why would buggy code suddenly choose to start crashing? It could be the result of someone attempting and repeatedly failing to guess at the location of a known vulnerable module.
I get it.
In an OS kernel that employs KASLR, whose kernel modules are randomized to occupy a different location in RAM for each boot. And that's, of course, done to specifically thwart this sort of hit or miss guessing attack. You would rather have the system crash than let the guy gain root on your system. Okay. So with that background, what this team, the Blindside guys, have done, this team of five brilliant researchers, Herbert Boss among them, who's, you know, he was the Rowhammer, the guys that nailed the Rowhammer attacks years ago. What they've managed to do is to figure out a way of completely neutering that powerful and arguably vital protection provided by KASLR by leveraging, get this, Leo, a system's Intel processor Spectre optimizations to repeatedly probe for the location of a known kernel bug in memory without ever crashing the system. And that's what you just watched in that video.
There was no crashes.
You watched a zero crash probe for a known bug that they were then able to leverage to give themselves root, and nothing crashed.
That's
so. Their paper is titled "Speculative Probing: Hacking Blind in the Spectre Era." And the video, for those who don't know, grc.sc/784, the number of today's podcast, 784, grc, you know, https://grc.sc/784. That will bounce you to a YouTube video where you can see this happen for yourself. And we've often quoted Bruce Schneier, saying attacks never get weaker, they only get stronger. Here, after about 21 months of awareness and exploration of Spectre and what Spectre can do, they are now leveraging Spectre to perpetrate an extremely practical attack. So, wow. Yeah.
How would they get it on the server, though? That's the question.
That is true. The Stanford attack was a remote attack that would cause crashes and then export the binary, which would then allow them to design a specific attack. Here, you would need to have code running on the server. On the other hand, if it was a VM, the problem with Spectre is that it's a cross-process leakage. So you could, for example, probe the hypervisor in order to determine, in order to penetrate its protections, in order to gain an advantage. So anyway, it just demonstrates that Spectre is no longer just like a lab curiosity for the academics. Oh, and I forgot to mention, the source for that is on GitHub.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Get to work.
Buckle up.
Jeez Louise.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'm just going to put a padlock on my server. That's all there is to it. Right there.
Secondly, we have completely different Blur Tooth. Here, I have four headlines. Blur Tooth vulnerability lets attackers defeat Bluetooth encryption. Bluetooth bug opens devices to man-in-the-middle attacks. Blur Tooth vulnerability lets attackers overwrite Bluetooth authentication keys. And finally, new unpatched Bluetooth flaw lets attackers easily target nearby devices. Everybody gets the idea that we've got a problem with Bluetooth. Blurtooth is the result of insufficiently strict requirements appearing in previous Bluetooth specifications from 4.0 through 5.0. Some tightening recommendations appeared in the minor 5.1 update, which was released in January of 2019, so a year and three quarters ago. The problem is it offered some weird additional features like direction finding for Bluetooth, which, you know, if you didn't need that, you just ignored it. So 5.1 said, you know, we've decided some things should be tightened. And by the way, here's a bunch of cool new tech. But a lot of people just said, okay, we don't need that. And they stayed with 5.0. So technically, the mistake was in allowing for cross-transport keying of pairing associations. And I'll explain what that means, of course. Devices that support two different transports, specifically both the Bluetooth Low Energy, BLE, and also the basic rate enhanced data rate, the so-called BR-EDR transport methods. Devices that support both, that is BLE and BR-EDR, are known as dual mode devices. And the earlier specs, as I said, allowed for those two differing transports to deliberately affect each other's pairing keys. This was designed deliberately because that protocol even has its own name and abbreviation. It's called cross transport key derivation, CTKD. It turns out, as originally implemented and as presently implemented by most dual mode devices, it's not as secure as they thought it was. CTKD pairing allows the devices to pair once using either transport method, while generating both the BREDR and the BLE long-term keys without needing to pair a second time. So back in the back when the committee was working on this on the Bluetooth protocols, they said, yeah, you know, why make them pair twice? If it's a dual mode, if the devices are dual mode and they're able to support both BLE and BREDR, let's just pair once. And then we'll use this CTKD, this cross transport keying mechanism, to pair the other side, the other mode. So once again, we get bitten by the desire for convenience, because dual mode devices using CTKD are able to overwrite the original long-term key or the link key in cases where that transport was enforcing a higher level of security. Okay, so for example, the Bluetooth spec introduced so-called just works pairing, right? For those instances where easy communications but less security is all that's needed. So for example, fitness trackers, maybe Bluetooth LE enabled jewelry, devices used to track, you know, a pet tag, or other technologies where you're just not concerned with sensitive information, you know, like a credit card or health data. You're not dealing with content. You're just dealing with, like, oh, you know, where, you know, how far away has Rover or Toaster gone, or is Toaster being attacked by chipmunk? Or something worse, a raccoon. Anyway, so just pair this just works technology is part of Bluetooth LE. Even when devices also support the deliberately far more secure BREDR pairing. As we know, one of the security enforcements for pairing is requiring a time-limited human-triggered event or some out-of-band communication, like where you use a PIN, which is not part of the wireless protocol, to enable high-security pairing. But two separate security research groups both independently discovered that it's possible to leverage that simple, unsupervised, non-secure offering, the so-called just works pairing, and use then the CTKD, the cross-transport key derivation, to break into and insecurely rekey the secure transport side. And that was never intended. So that's a big whoopsie. There's no doubt that there are places where this would be a problem. The implementers of Bluetooth-connected systems might have deliberately implemented both transports under the entirely reasonable assumption, I mean, and it is so stated in the spec, that the two transports were cryptographically isolated from one another, as indeed they were intended to be. So, for example, imagine that some industrial control system uses a one-time, highly secure pairing to communicate with its controlling monitor system. But as a convenience, it also allows for just works pairing to be used with any nearby smartphone for read-only passive monitoring. That's an entirely reasonable architectural design decision. But now, unfortunately, any of those nearby unauthorized smartphones which are able to pair over just works Bluetooth low energy now have the means to intercept, rekey, and perform an active man-in-the-middle attack against the main control link that was assumed to be super secure. So for those using the Bluetooth features of versions 4.0 through 5.0, as I mentioned before, there was no push or rush to implement the tighter restrictions which were added in 5.1. If 5.1's additional functional enhancements were not needed, then why bother, since 5.0 was assumed to be secure? That all changed last week. So we can expect to see a move to version 5.1 on any dual mode Bluetooth devices, you know, like all of our smartphones have that also now offer BLE. So as always the case, those Bluetooth devices that are not part of some actively maintained upgrade cycle, like Gulp, maybe some process monitoring hardware, which is no longer being maintained or, you know, dynamically updated. Everything that is stopped at 5.0 will forever remain vulnerable to this newly revealed class of cross-transport attack. And so what we are seeing is we are gradually creating a growing environment of long-term vulnerabilities that are more than likely never going to get fixed. And you just have to think that there are state-level actors and agencies that are not missing a single one of these. They are adding, you know, to a large and growing portfolio of ways to attack this, ways to attack that. And these things are never going to get fixed. So a bit of a brave new world that we are creating as a consequence of the unfixable debris that we are leaving behind as we're continuing to better learn how to do these things as we move forward. Unfortunately, we're depending upon the ability to fix our mistakes in the past, and that's a strictly time-limited ability.